if you listen to the program on a regular basis, you know when you hear that kind of music, we're going to talk about Vietnam. I'm not sure why it is like that. It just is. So joining me is a fellow member of the 5th Marine Regiment alumni, Nick War. Nick, first of all, good morning to you, and welcome to All Marine Radio.
Good morning to you, and I appreciate your invitation.
No, not a problem. Before we talk about some of the things that you have going on these days, let's talk about you. Born and raised where?
Actually, I'm a third-generation native of Southern California. I was born in the San Gabriel Valley, actually, in a town called Monterey Park. So, I spent 6 years there, and then my parents moved us up to rural coastal Oregon, which is where I went through school.
All right. So, Southern California to rural coastal Oregon. Up with all the peaceniks up there. How does the, where do you go to college? How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
I'd like to tell you I had a plan, but it just has fallen putting one foot in front of the other. I got out of high school. I went to college for a year and a half at Brigham Young. My family is Mormon. And I got a good education for a year and a half there, and then I went a half year at University of Oregon. And at this point, I was kind of bored with life, and, still a fairly young guy. And so I decided to try something new. And at about that time, I was walking down Main Street in Eugene, Oregon, and I saw a Navy recruiting poster, which showed a naval aviator, very tall and good-looking, standing in front of his aircraft and with his helmet under his arm, and I thought he looked pretty cool. So I went into the Navy recruiting office, and the first question they asked me was where I had graduated from college. And since I hadn't done that, I answered their question honestly, and they said, well, you can't go see an aviator in the Navy without a four-year education. So he said, go next door and talk to the gunny. That was my introduction to the United States Marine Corps with an old grizzled gunnery sergeant who was my recruiter. And in about an hour, I had signed up for 4 years and was headed for boot camp with a four-month delay. So I got to boot camp June of 1966.
All right, so you have no affiliation with the Marine Corps growing up, which is always interesting. And had you ever encountered Marines? Had you ever
hardly at all, except for obviously in the movies. Growing up, I was born in 1945, so my entire youth was the games we played was either Cowboys and Indians or it was, the Marines on the beach kind of stuff. But nothing really specific. Just ended up in boot camp, and it's everything that everybody has ever said. It's all true. It's pretty amazing. Your life changes rather dramatically, and I did pretty well with it, and when I came out the other end of boot camp, I had been recommended for the enlisted commissioning program in the Marine Corps, which meant that they were going to cut me orders to go to Quantico and go through officer candidate school, which I did, and I then joined the class of 567 at the basic school. That's about 520 of us, and in those days, since the war was at its height, it really was a tremendous, they churned out a tremendous number of infantry officers in the Marine Corps in the summer of 1967. So, one of the kind of obscure parts of my story, but I think it's important, is that I did not fail the Army Language Aptitude Test, which everybody takes, and only 11 of us out of 520 did not fail it. Everybody else failed it, got straight F's on the thing, meaning they didn't think they could teach you a foreign language. So I ended up, instead of going 30 days leave and then over the choppy seas, meaning Westpac, I was delayed 6 weeks going to a high-intensity Vietnamese language training school where the 11 of us basically from the morning of the first day for 6 solid weeks, we just spoke Vietnamese. We didn't really know what we were saying, but we could kind of communicate with each other. So I ended up arriving in the Republic of Vietnam on November 15th, 1967. And I think I was very fortunate in that I was assigned to the 5th Marine Regiment, the Fighting 5th. I will tell you right away that my bubble burst on the language thing because one of the first people I tried to talk to that day was an old Vietnamese farmer with a mouthful of betel nut. And I was just simply trying to say hello. The most basic phrase in the Vietnamese language is chào ông, which is hello, sir. And after about 10 minutes of him pretty much panicking, I realized what he was saying back to me is, I'm sorry, but I don't speak English. So I was in trouble when it came to the language barrier, which was dramatic. Okay. We learned pidgin Vietnamese, and they knew some pidgin English, so we ended up communicating. But that's my story. It's probably one of the things that saved my life was getting there 6 weeks late. Because a few things took place that kind of opened my eyes a little bit. But there I was, and I spent 13 months in Vietnam as a Marine infantry officer. And I held the job, the basic job as platoon commander, which is you're in charge of about 50 guys in infantry platoon. I did that job for 8 months, and then I was a company executive officer, which is you're the assistant to the company commander. For an infantry company, and then I ended up commanding a H&S company, if you can really call it commanding. I was a first lieutenant by that time, and really H&S company, if you know anything about them, you just stand out of the way and let the gunnies and the staff sergeants do everything. Not leading a group of guys.
And then you get hauled in front and take blame for things they do, and then you go back and you say, hey, why are you doing this? They say, oh, sir, don't worry about it.
Sounds like you've been there and done that.
You know what? I've never done it. I sure as hell watched him get wire brushed, though. And I've always sat there and thought, you know what? He has no control over what's going on. Thank God I'm not him. So you get to 1-5, and what company do you go to?
Into Charlie Company, and was given command of the 1st Platoon at Charlie Company. Right out of the chute. Everybody's belief was that we were ready to rock and roll. We were ready to just take command. And I learned kind of the hard way that it took me about a month to really go from what I was supposed to be, which is a polished and very ready infantry officer, to being that. And I was real lucky in that. You don't have a lot of choice in these matters. You know, you don't basically say, hey, I want to have a platoon at Charlie Company and I want John Mullen as my platoon sergeant. They simply, they show up. Here you are. This is your job and this is the people you're going to be working with. Mother, we call them Mother or Mother depending on the circumstances, but John, Staff Sergeant John Mother Mullen was one of the best things that happened to me when I got to Vietnam, because he had been doing my job, my new job, as a staff sergeant. He had had a second lieutenant platoon commander for a couple of weeks when he first got to Vietnam in September, but then he blew out his knee and they evacuated. That was the last time you saw him. So John was doing the job and he is, he's a 10 or 11 year career guy. His lifelong ambition was to become the sergeant major of the Marine Corps, so he was motivated and he worked hard and he was really good at what he did. And he essentially sent me through finishing school for about 30 days and upon my request. And we kept that a secret for a long time, but it was one of the smarter things I did.
Interesting. No, you know what, since then, the Marine Corps has instituted the Infantry Officer Course, which takes You want a graduate level, I don't know, graduate level, but certainly another 13 weeks of learning your craft and honing it a little bit.
I think that terminology is perfect. That's exactly what IOC is.
And then, but it still doesn't, when you still go to the operating forces, there is still that, I don't know, I've never been involved in this, I don't know what I'm doing, I've read a lot about it, I pretended, but this is different, and obviously lucky to have a platoon sergeant who you could have that kind of relationship with, because a lot of guys didn't go to that kind of relationship. It was a little bit more adversarial and probably weren't as comfortable with their platoon sergeant, and probably cost them. Any time we're not as good, it certainly costs in terms of casualties.
Well, in my case, it was certainly the luck of the draw.
And so
Sergeant Mullen, mother just did an absolute fantastic job. So he went down real hard on the first day of the Battle for Wei, which we ended up being heavily involved in. And that was one of the worst days of my life, is when he... the doc didn't think he was going to survive his wound. So anyway, yeah, he was a great guy. He's still alive today. He's doing well.
Wow.
I was hoping he was going to go on our trip, but he had promised his wife to take her back to Ireland one more time, and they're in their late 70s now. You know, so
right.
I'm 72. He's like 78 or 79. And they said, let's go to Ireland. So they went for 3 weeks, and it kicked his ass, the long flights and stuff like that. So he just said, hey, I can't do that anymore. So unfortunately, he's not coming to Vietnam with us. But we'll be thinking about him and remembering his laugh. He's an incredible guy.
You know what? First of all, we're fellow Charlie 1-5 guys, except...
Are you really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I had 3rd platoon, not 1st platoon, 3rd platoon. Those guys have been shit for a long time, so thank God we've always had 3rd platoon to pull their asses out of the fire when necessary.
No, the 3rd platoon was always referred to as the 3rd herd. Okay,
and still is. When I had them, though, it was like... The question was, why is 3rd always in front? My Marines love that shit.
I don't know.
My Marines love that shit.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, because you jackasses get lost all the time. He's the only one that can read a map. Get out there.
I can tell you lots of stories about being stupid, fortunately, that didn't get anybody.
Well, you were doing your work. I was doing mine at Camp Pendleton. You were doing yours in Vietnam, so a little bit different. Tell me about, you get to Vietnam. Where are you guys?
Yep.
Where's 1-5 operating?
At that point in time, we had just basically moved from... down in the Quezon Valley, the battalion moved from the Quezon Valley to Hoi An, which is about 20 clicks due south of Da Nang, okay? And it's set right off of Highway 1. So Hoi An was actually one of the oldest cities in the entire country. This place was a Chinese trading post for like 4 centuries before it became formalized. But anyway, Hoi An was VC... nightmare. It was just a non-stop, you never knew if something you stepped on was going to blow up or not. I mean, it's just that way. And occasional snipers, and every once in a while, a terrible command detonated bombs, okay, and it would just come out of nowhere. That was my introduction to Vietnam. It sucked big time, and believe me, I can speak to all the different kinds of warfare we faced during that entire war, which was multiple different iterations, if you will.
You know, one of the interesting things, Nick, that I've learned, one of the things I've learned a lot about, I've learned in doing this show for a couple of years, I've learned a ton about post-combat related mental health. I've learned a bunch about the oral tradition in which some of that stuff was handed down because we didn't have people that helped other people. We helped each other. I've also learned a ton about transitioning. The third thing I tell you I've learned a ton about is Vietnam is such a different war depending on what year you're there and then what part of the country you're in. And so to
where
me,
you were and what you did is important too. Absolutely.
And so to me, when you tell me I was south of Da Nang immediately I know that that's VC country. And
so
talk to us. So on a daily basis, in that part, this is before TET, pre-TET. So
right.
So what are you guys doing? Are you guys going on search and destroy operations, coordinate search operations, looking for the VC, all of that?
There was a hierarchy within the area called Hoi An. There was actually a regimental combat base, a separate battalion combat base, and there was at least one other separate company size combat base. Okay. And so the 5th Marine Regiment, which was by far the biggest combat base structure and so forth, was maybe 3 or 4 clicks, and that's all away from the main combat base in Hoi An, which is the battalion one. They basically put up about a 20-foot high sand berm all the way through this thing. I was there maybe 1 or 2 days during the whole 2 months that I was there. And then there's this Charlie Company combined outpost, meaning we had the Arvin or the Roughbuffs or whoever they were inside of our lines. Okay, that was a little strange. But the routine for a company, as you know, there's 3 platoons. Each platoon has 3 squads. Generally speaking, we would rotate duties on a platoon basis. So for 2 or 3 days, my job would be to take Charlie 1 out on a long-range recon slash whatever you need me to do patrol. Typically 2 nights, 3 days. You'd go out combat loaded with everything you needed the last 3 days. And you just wander around the neighborhood and see what's going on. While I'm doing that, 2nd Platoon is responsible for local patrols around the combat base and night ambush patrols. And then the other responsibility is the primary responsibility for manning the bunkers around the hardened position, okay? So you just rotate that way. So every 3 days you'd go from maybe getting a good night's sleep, but having to do a lot of daytime patrolling and the worst, which was night ambush patrols. So that's kind of the way it was. And in Hoi An, it was a reactive deal from the beginning to the end. We never saw them. We hardly saw, signs of them. And then all of a sudden, boom. You know, we've lost 4 guys, and that just sucks. So we left Hoi An actually on Christmas Eve of 1967, and half of us went by convoy, and the other half went by, I was in a CH-53 helicopter, which was, you know, those things were amazing. Anyway, we went all the way from Hoi An south of Da Nang to, across the Hai Van Pass and into a new combat base called Fulak 6. And that sucked in a different way. they all kind of sucked, but this place was almost really fun for 2 or 3 weeks. The mountain stream with swimming holes and stuff like that, you know, clean water. We just took over a new mountain. It wasn't a very high mountain, but they bulldozed the sucker off and dug ditches all the way around it. And so that was 1-5's combat outpost from basically Christmas Day of 67 until when we went into Wei.
And give me where geographically is that combat base?
Okay, so... are you familiar with where the Hai Van Pass is?
I am not.
Okay, so you're in Da Nang. Da Nang is the major logistics center for all of I Corps. It's the dominant city. And it has a huge deep water harbor.
Right.
Natural. It's all natural. That's where the 1st Marine Division headquarters is as well. Okay.
Right.
You go north. You have to go almost immediately up the side of this mountain and across what's called the Hai Van Pass. It goes up about, I think the elevation gets up to maybe 5,000-6,000 feet and something like that. They measure it in meters, but the Hai Van Pass is spectacular, but it's also known as what we call the convoy killer, because, you know, switchback roads and lots of foliage and often every two or three convoys would get hit somehow, either big or small.
And that's going straight north on almost along like the coast highway, if you will, over the Hi-Von Pass.
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. It sort of reminds me, I grew up on the Oregon coast, okay.
Right.
So Pacific Coast Highway is spectacular, but Highway 1 in Vietnam in some areas rivals it.
Wow. Actually,
I'm
looking at a map of Vietnam right now. So, I see the Hi-Von Pass right now. So from there, which way are we going?
Yeah. We're going north, and we go down the other side of the Hi-Von Pass and into a town called Lang Co. You'll see there's a sea water bay to your left. And there's a bridge that goes right across it. And
right.
The village itself, it was one of few totally Christian villages that we spent any time at during our time up in that area. That bridge is a tidal bridge. It's very long. It goes maybe 600, 700, 800 feet, 1,000 feet. It goes a long ways across that opening. And when the tides are going, the water is coming in and going out pretty fast. So if that bridge ever got blown, they would not have been able to repair it with pontoon bridges. That's why it was so strategically important. All the time we were there, the village chief, who is an Arvin captain or first lieutenant, kept coming and telling us, hey, they're going to hit the bridge tonight. They didn't want us to leave. They never hit the bridge while we were there, but after Tet, they did. They blew that thing up. Some army unit went in there and had it, took it over from us, and they blew the whole damn thing. They had to completely rebuild it. So that's Lang Co. If you go, continue north, Highway 1 goes over another lower pass called the Fujia Pass, which was the terrain for Delta Company's little small artillery outposts. I don't know. You haven't read my books yet, right?
I have not.
Okay, so, you know, the guys at 1-5 referred to Charlie Company as Suicide Charlie, and everybody else referred to Delta Company as Dying Delta. It's simply because it seemed like whatever, you know, was going on, they get the short end of the stick.
Right.
You know, they get stuck out in the middle of nowhere. And so anyway, this Fujia Pass, you go over that, and then you continue north, and you're going to be looking for Phu Lạc. It's actually a cluster of villages, and it's an intersection, a significant intersection on Highway 1, where you'll see a surface road that goes west up into the mountains. You go to the end of that road is called Bac Ma, which is an old French resort. It's up another 2,000 or 3,000 meters, so it's quite a ways up in elevation and beautiful. About two clicks up that road, there's a little rise, and that's where we built that base. It was right on a main east-west supply route. You know, the NVA had been using it since the French had been there. It was an interesting place. It was almost idyllic for 2 weeks, and then the shit hit the fan, and we were to the point where we were taking upwards of 1,000 rounds of incoming a day, from small recoilless rifles to 60 and 81, 82 millimeter mortars to larger, you know, the larger rockets would come from quite a ways up on the side of that mountain. It was the only place, my company commander, who will remain nameless at this point, but he was a Canoe U guy.
Right.
And was a captain. The guy was scared to death the whole time he was there, you know. He didn't do anything bad, but you could just tell that he was just scared. He didn't really want to be outside the wire. But anyway, it was the only time he ever volunteered us to go outside the wire, because it was just too crazy in that combat base.
So
no,
we're gonna get outside the wire because it's too dangerous inside.
Yes. Yeah. We didn't object, by the way. We did not gripe or complain or anything. We just
That's not exactly the way we draw it up.
Oh, geez.
No, but you know what? It is But you do see it. You do see it when you go to war. There's some people that, for whatever reason, they cannot put their fear behind them, and their sense of duty doesn't outweigh their fear, which I, most other people, I think you've seen, or let me ask you, have you seen Band of Brothers, Nick?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody who's who sees the scenes in there where that lieutenant looks at a private by the name of Blythe and says, Blythe, until you accept the fact that you're already dead, you can't function as a soldier.
Yep.
You know, it sounds crazy, but I think everybody who's been to combat listens to that and says, no
yep.
shit. That it,
yep.
And
yep.
so it, and so if you can't make peace with that, you can't function, and, you know, and so some people can't, and they don't function. And obviously, it's not a good thing when your company commander is that guy, though. You know, hopefully
no,
that's
but, well, he really, I'm going to go easy on him because he really didn't, you know, didn't outwardly display it. But it's this little thing. It's like he, you know, whenever he went to sleep at night, he'd put his feet on the floor off the end of the cot. He always had his 45 on his chest and his helmet's on, his button. Yeah, we're all going, okay, I'm getting my rubber lady out now. Anyway, I think fear is a good thing for most of us, you know, because it's got a purpose. And when you see stuff that scares you, you better do something, you know.
Right.
But anyway.
Talk to us about, so give me your thoughts, you know, 50 years coming up, since battles that we've all read about as younger Marines,
right.
Kaysan, Hue. Talk to us about, the experience of Hue. I imagine you could talk about it all day, but, being as we're going to talk about other things and give me, When you think about it as a lieutenant, what do you think about when you recall Hue?
Well, the very first thing that comes to my mind when I first start thinking about this, which I usually do sometime every day for at least the last 20 years, is it's one of those hard to believe how beautiful it is places, exotic. The place itself, okay, the geography, the terrain, okay, it was just like nothing we'd ever seen. You know, we spent most of the time out in the bush in these little dinky villages, and sometimes not even villages, just hooches. And now all of a sudden we're inside a major, substantial city, but it's not like downtown Saigon. It's this really historic place. So that's the first thing, just the fact of the battlefield, the fact that we were fighting in people's houses in this ancient, critically historic and historic town with lots of important buildings, that's the first thing. The second thing that immediately then comes is the tragedy of this particular battle, okay, in history is that it was being fought in people's houses and in important symbolic places, and thus the people who do the final planning in a combat operation it pretty much starts from very high up the chain of command and does not always involve people that are active duty military whose job it is to assess the situation and develop a plan. And in those days, and during our war, way too often, these things were done, with politics in mind, with, you know, the politically motivated, prosecution of war. And it essentially comes from what are called rules of engagement. You do a combat operation, you say, okay, this is what we want you to do. This is your mission. This is how we want you to do it, and this is what you can and cannot do as you're prosecuting this, because, you know, this is a war, and in war, you know, you're trying to kill people, and they often do die, and and you're trying to accomplish the mission and trying to keep the bloody part of it down as much as possible. And I'll tell you, and I saw this over and over again, when it came to us planning those combat operations, we did take time and worried about, you know, quote-unquote collateral damage, which is one of the worst word, you know, combinations I know. But, I mean, it was artificially forcing us to fight with our hands behind our backs. And the insane part about it is that this battle took place over about 5 weeks, the entire battle, the battle they call the Battle for Way City, which is really the Tet Offensive in many parts of Way and in many other towns and cities all up and down the entire country, you know. They first formed a battle plan on the 31st of January after this had, the night of the 30th and the day of the 31st is when they first started shooting at us. And they were there in force. They established those very overly restrictive rules of engagement, essentially said, we want you to attack and destroy, meaning we want you to go in there and shoot them and kill them, the people that are inside these buildings, which used to be somebody's house, but right now they're enemy headquarters positions or their defensive positions. And by the way, we don't want you to harm the structures. So you can go in there and just be a Marine and kill everybody you can, but you cannot use supporting arms. You can't use a tank, can't use the tank's cannon, can't use artillery, don't drop any bombs, but you've got your small arms, so, you know, we'll probably break a few windows, but that's essentially what they were instructed to do. It's what they attempted to do for 6 days, and the result of that was very little progress in those first 6 days, with a tremendous amount of blood lost on our side and on their side, both sides. But it's like, I don't know if you've ever, do you know who Joe Dunford is?
He's a friend of mine, yes.
Okay. Joe famously said before Congress that I'm not planning to send Americans into a fair fight. Everybody should pay attention to that because that's the way the military is supposed to work. You're supposed to build up your forces. You're supposed to be overwhelming in size. You're supposed to mount all of your resources. You're supposed to come up with a detailed plan on how you're going to destroy these places and these people and get it over with as quickly as possible without causing as much harm as possible. But for 6 days, those rules were completely preventing that. And so when they changed, for the next 6 or 7 days after that, first Marines and 2-5 and that whole group were finally able to do what they were paid to do. Then at the end of the second week, we kind of skip by them. We go inside the Citadel. We somehow managed to get in there without firing a shot, which is, when you look at it from a historical point of view and you look at it from a distance, you go, man, that right there, just the fact that we got inside that huge structure without anybody shooting at us and vice versa, that was huge. That was a good first step. But then for the next 3 days, this is Tuesday, February 13th, 14th, and 15th, they decided to try the overly restrictive and insane rules of engagement approach again, knowing full well it hadn't worked the first time, and it's only a week ago. They say, here, you guys go try this now. And my story is kind of underscored, and I get a lot of motivation from the fact that through a twist of fate, my platoon ended up being the only attack element that day. There were 50 guys, three machine guns, and all the rest of them were M16s, which you really still couldn't quite trust totally, you know, but they've gotten better. No supporting arms, tanks on both sides of my flanks, and they were shooting the machine guns, but they've never fired a cannon round at any target for those first 3 days. Until finally somebody got their head out of their butt and changed. And by the way, that somebody is a real legendary guy in the Marine Corps. His name is Victor Brute Krulak. The three-star was FMS Pack. And when that was all going on and we were just losing guys left and right, my platoon was essentially rendered ineffective in one day under those conditions, required to carry out essentially three frontal assaults against heavily defended enemy positions that had been built for 2 weeks and had lots and lots of guys in them. You know, they just kept saying attack. It was, so my answer is pretty complex. It's like, how was I feeling on that first day? Well, not very good. I really, sometimes, you know, think back on that and wonder how I kept my sanity. I probably didn't there for a while, at least on that day. So, by the way, I'm an avid learner about PTSD and have been for those 20 years since my memories came back 20 years ago, which started inspiring my writing. And so that's kind of the genesis of the Nick War story.
No, interesting. I'd never heard the rules of engagement issue relative to Hue. It's something that goes with every conflict, and it's something that you wrestle with in terms of the loss of civilian lives. And especially when you have an enemy that is using them as shields and as part of their defense. How much blood of your own do you spill in an effort to try to be gentle with the local population? And we wrestled with that during Fallujah. I was helping out, doing a little bit of planning as I was working for, that's where I met General Mattis, General Kelly, and Colonel Dunfer was the chief of staff there. And so I was working for General Mattis, and Colonel Dunfer sent me into a planning session, and he said, "Hey, Mac, I want you to sit in here, tell me what kind of rudder steer I need to give to it." And the planning session was about, do we put up refugee camps when we get after Fallujah? And based on the amount of troops that it would take to guard the thing, because once you create it, now it's going to be a target, so you got to guard it, or lest you be blamed for their death. After about an hour, they took a break. I walked in, and he looked at me. He said, "So," I said, "we shouldn't do it. The tax is too much." And relative to upwards of, you know, maybe a battalion of Marines to guard the damn thing. And then the Iraqis get out of the way. They got out of the way during the march up. Most of them have gotten out of the way now, and we have to be content with that. And there may be a price to pay for that, but there's a bigger price to pay if you concentrate them in one area. So let them, and, you know, and so that those are the life and death discussions you have relative to the rules of engagement, because you know that if you restrain yourself like the ROE that you operated under, there's a price that comes with that, and that was the price of your platoon, the Marines of your platoon and company, and that's brutal. That's brutal. I don't know how you, you know, it sounds to me almost like Civil War stuff where we get told, okay, reform, we're going to go back up the hill. What?
Right. Yeah. Put your bandits back on.
Yeah. All right, suck it up, boys. Get some more ammunition. We're going to go back up there. Are you kidding
me?
Well,
what you've just been talking about is really, I think, it's in the heart of my soul. I have no other way to put it. This whole conversation about, and you already pointed it out, it has to do with leadership. And in my mind, it has to do with being an effective leader. And the one thing that I know that the Marine Corps has had for quite some time now that we didn't have back in 1967, and that was the leadership principles and traits. And I've studied those for now 20 years, 20 plus years, and recognize the value in them. And, you know, the thing that, again, is uppermost in my mind is one of those principles is employ your command in accordance with its abilities. And if you think about that and you really try to accomplish that, you have to know what your command can do and what it can't do in virtually every one of those situations, because every situation is a little different, you know, sometimes dramatically different. And that's one of the real challenges of our story, in that, you know, we had not trained for urban combat. We had a little introduction to it. We hadn't even been in any of these combat towns that they have today. You know,
Oh my God. We
had villages. We had, Vietnamese villages. We didn't have combat towns. And, so what I tell people is, you know, when you're training, you got to train for what you expect. You got to train for what you don't even think about, you know, which you can't always do that, but, anyway, this is quite a fascinating conversation, because there are those parallels. You said you were in Fallujah. There were two big battles in Fallujah. Fallujah 1, Fallujah 2. I don't think they call them that, but.
That's what we call them.
April and, yeah. And November, right?
Yeah. I was in Ramadi. And where the division CP was, and so I went to work for General Mattis, and then after he rotated out, the CG's name was Natonsky. He wanted me because he liked me. He was a Yankee fan, and so was I. So he's like, "Max, you got to stay on as a staff sec." I said, "Sir, I cannot do this stuff anymore." I said, "Come on, I'm a grunt." I said, "Can I want," he goes, and then he says, "Where do you want to go?" I said, "Current ops." And I said, "That's what I want to do." And he said, "Okay." So during Fallujah number two, I worked in current operations, as the division got after, right after the election, got after Fallujah the second time. So both of them, and the rules of engagement. Constantly, and in current ops, you know, you're trying to make that call, you know, with, you know, now we have precision guided munitions. We can fly in a certain window. We can hit a specific truck. You know, we don't have to lay down a battery six, you know, to do it. And it makes the job of getting the X-Acto knife, you know, and sparing civilian life easier. Doesn't make it perfect, but it makes it easier and mistakes still happen. And it sucked because, you know, now with social media, somebody, you know, it knocks down a wall, it knocks down another house, and a family gets crushed and killed, and now they're streaming video of it live, and it's your fault.
And you even make mistakes that, you know, and the problem is that the general human race doesn't really understand.
No. All they know is they see the drama.
You're going to have a war, you're going to have some people hurt. Sorry. I mean, there's no way to stop it.
And if they're not, and this is the importance of having guys like Secretary Mattis as the Secretary of Defense, his credibility, guys like Joe Dunford in his position, and obviously I served with both of them, so I'm huge fans, but General Mattis has an aura that I think commands respect by the way he conducts himself, his frankness, and his brains. And when he speaks, people listen. And I don't know that that's always the case. And it's important, for instance, I'll go back to your war. You know, when people see pictures, you know, of, you know, that little girl running down the road, you know, without any clothes because of the napalm strike.
Yep.
You know what?
Yep.
There's footnotes that need to go with that. Because sometimes accidents happen in war and other things, and you have to steel your population, but it's so hard now in the era of social media, and the urination video of the Marines is a perfect example. The reaction to that was so over the top, as opposed to the sin that they committed. And first of all, what they did was wrong. It's a sign of poor leadership, because when you begin to deviate from the path,
right,
you can't stop it once you decide we're going to operate by our own rules and we're going to pick and choose.
You just started to push your toe across that line in the sand, and there's no stopping it.
And there's no stopping it. And so, and that's why when you see that, the social media takes that and it puts it on steroids and it whips it into Mach 2 and you can't control it. And so it's difficult. But as you said, it's about leadership. When you have the right people and they're given the right rudder steer and you're doing your best to avoid civilian casualties, but at the end of the day, you have got to be responsible to your Marines and do what's in their best interest, or don't send them in there. Or just say, look, we're going to surround Hue and we're going to wait this thing out. We're going to starve them. We'll do something else, but we're not going to go in there and go door to door and only use rifles. That is not how we're going to do this.
While that whole thing was going on, there was such a sense of almost insane urgency coming from higher, coming from just all the, everybody up there in that mix, all the way back in the White House and, you know, the presidential palace of South Vietnam. It's the thing that really drives me and why I do the things I do today still is because of that connection, of that situation in Hue City, which is, you know, all historically documented now.
Right.
And Jim Mattis thanking me and shaking my hand because in OIF-1, the rules were balanced so that when they did start taking enemy fire from a mosque or a holy shrine, it's a defensive position. Take it out, move on. That's what Jim Mattis, that's the orders he gave.
Right.
And that was great. And we did kind of a moving target since then too, though. So,
well, you know what? But you know what? Because of those discussions that we've had, based a lot of it based on Vietnam experiences, you know, and then trying to hype, you know, trying to transpose it into future conflicts. We had discussed those. When is a mosque not a mosque? Well, when it's being used as a military fortification, a military position. In that case, it is not a mosque anymore, and it's as clear as black and white. Now there might be, you might have to check with, instead of just your battalion, you might have to go to regiment or division to get it cleared. But once you paint the picture for them, it was blow it away. And so
one of the things that Sun Tzu says is, you know, this is obviously ancient times, but he always talks about the emperor. So the emperor is not on the battlefield. So if he received orders from the emperor and they make absolutely no sense, then you don't need to listen to him. Which, that kind of stuff happened a lot too.
Well, that was Frederick the Great's quote, right? You know, when asked, like, what do you, you know, a general saying, what are you going to do when Frederick finds out about this? Well, he's not here, and until I speak to him, my job is to use my head. Afterwards, he can have it. Or it was words to that effect. While it's still on my shoulders, I intend to use it. And so, timeless, I think, advice on the battlefield when it comes to these kind of life and death decisions. Go ahead. You were going to make
I was just saying that it, the net effect for me, and you know, you've mentioned and brought up PTSD a few times, and I'm knowledgeable about that. I had to be because, you know, I got it, and so do a lot of other guys that I know who still to this day kind of are in denial to some degree, but that whole thing, well, that was an eye-opener when I learned about what that's all about. And up until that moment, I really thought, you know, it's not me. I don't have that kind of problem in life, but it's there. And I take my hat off to you for the work you do for spreading the word and providing. I think you're somehow organized so that you're supporting therapeutic situation. So.
Well, it's our tribe, and it is our tribe is characterized by post-traumatic stress, amputees, traumatic brain injuries, and it's all part of our tribes. On a regular basis, I'll see a relatively young person with a prosthetic device and walk up to him and say, "Where did you get that?" And my daughters just went, they're like, "Dad."
And you can't do that.
You can't do that. And it's like, no, I know he's part of my tribe. Okay. And so it doesn't matter to us.
Yeah.
But Dad, come on. Where did you get that? I got it at the VA. No. Where did it happen? Oh, in Afghanistan. Yeah. What year?
Yep.
2010. Yep. What province? Helmand. You're a Marine? Yeah. Hey, I'm Mike McNamara. I was there in 10/11. And then all of a sudden, maybe you crossed paths. Maybe you didn't. You know, I've had guys on this program that I medevac. And you're like, holy shit.
No kidding.
Yeah, medevac your ass.
That's cool.
And like, hey, sir, that medevac got there fast, thanks. And like, it is cool. But the mission of this is nobody gave us PTSD. We fucking earned it fighting for our country. Like every guy who's gone to fight for their country throughout history, we need to know that it's a normal byproduct. You're not damaged. You're fucked up a little bit, but you're not damaged because of it. And this is our new normal. And so don't fret about it. Make sure you go talk to people about it. Stay in touch with your battle buddies because that'll help. And get the help.
That really helps.
Get the help that you need to go and live your life. I just, I said this a few times on my program. People that listen, forgive me. But I haven't said it to you, Nick. But I just watched something about Elizabeth Smart. The show is called I Am Elizabeth Smart. And if you get a chance, when you see it on Lifetime, watch it. Okay.
Okay.
I know it's a little bit difficult to me to recommend a program on Lifetime on All Marine Radio, but I don't care. I'm doing it anyway. Elizabeth Smart, kidnapped for 9 months.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Out of Salt Lake City. Raped almost on a nightly basis. Is an incredible woman. She talks about life is worth living. These events don't need to define you. You can take your life back. And the positive message that she has after what she's been through, you sit there and watch it and go, holy shit, man. If she can do it, I know, I've got to be able to do it because what she went through, pretty, pretty rough for a 14-year-old girl.
Yep.
And listen to the things that she's saying. So, I mean, that is All Marine Radio. It's that effort to normalize.
That's really cool.
Yeah, normalize. And you know what's really cool is it's timeless. We have similar experience in different conflicts. And then I was just watching it, and I played the other day, and I'll send you the link so you can listen to it.
Okay.
There's a documentary called Bravo! Common Men, Uncommon Valor. It's about Queso.
I know Ken Rogers personally.
Have you seen the video?
Oh, yes.
Okay. That
is wonderful.
This was recorded, it's now 50 years, so this was recorded probably 47, 48 years after Quezon.
I think he started working on it maybe 4 years ago, yeah. Okay.
So when they're describing the Ghost Patrol, and then when they went, and then another event that they call the Payback, they describe it in high definition, right? And if you watch their faces when they're talking about it, they're living it. And I think what's important for young Marines, and the reason why they should watch it is, you need to know the things that you may see, you'll never get over. Okay, you'll hopefully learn to coexist with it, and that's important.
Right.
And the reason we're telling you this is that that's going to be normal for you. You're not damaged. You're not fucked up. Right, it's just a different you, and you have the privilege of being a warrior and being part of the warrior caste of our nation, and you join an exclusive fraternity. It comes with some downside. This is it. You can grow with it. There's a thing called post-traumatic growth that guys use this, and Elizabeth Smart's a great example, using trauma as almost a fulcrum to do greater things. And so we don't want you to consider yourself damaged. You're not. Because the best parties you can ever go to are full of guys with post-traumatic stress because crazy shit always happens, right?
Yeah.
They're awesome parties. And so
yeah, and if you If you drop a glass of red wine, you say, "Yep, we're all fucked up."
Exactly. So no, laugh. Right? And we laugh. Yeah, we are. Right. This thing's about to get ripping too after you have a few glasses of wine. But no, I think it's a beautiful, necessary thing that fortifies all of us. And you guys have given so much back to the culture anyway. I love the way you guys. The Greatest Generation had nothing on you guys, in terms of what you guys experienced when you came through and still the way you contribute to younger guys like me, our education about things like post-traumatic stress. So I don't know that there's any way that we can say thank you to you guys.
Well, that was one of the things when I started, the situation was, 22 years ago, my first book had been published just now. Guys started making phone calls. I mean, I had no contact with Marine Corps for nearly 30 years, and all of a sudden the phone's ringing, and these guys, so I start getting together with them, like Mother Mullen and others, and that's when the whole healing process begins. But it had to do with my book. It got in the right hands very rapidly. It was on a Marine reading list, and that resulted in my ability. I also used to live in Southern California for a long time, so I was easy to go to Camp Pendleton and meet some of these guys that are getting up there in rank, and I would often, sometimes rudely, just shove my book in their hand and say, "Here, General, read this book. You know, here's read this blah, blah book, okay? You need to read this book." And they did. These guys are, as you know, they're tremendous people. They really believe in history and the lessons that you can learn if you take your time and you do this stuff right. And I haven't been disappointed with that part of our country for a long time, but that's only a half of 1%. The challenge we have is that there are so many people in our country today that have not experienced being of service. Okay? They've, and I think that's really important. So, I'm getting off on a little tangent here, but, I'm talking about service to the nation and how the effect of that on an individual makes a huge difference. But it was the fact that it was beginning to instruct young people in the military on what not to do primarily. I think, this is my own opinion, and I think most Vietnam veterans would agree with this, that when a lot of the books that were written about the Vietnam War weren't 100%, this is the way to do this, okay? It's usually, we should have done this and that and the other thing, but, you know, we couldn't do that because it would have made somebody unhappy. And so this is what we did, and we're telling you, don't do that. Do it different. Do it the right way. You know, learn in the classroom. Don't learn out on the in the bush. So,
you know, but anyway, there's a frankness, though, that comes with the Vietnam writing you know, World War II has a lot of mythology, and you don't read about too many things that went wrong. You read about an awful lot of things that went right. And so I don't want to say that it's romanticized, because I think the writing has gotten different over the years. But I will say that Vietnam deals with failure on a regular basis. And I think we all learn more from our failures than we do from our victories. And I think it's very, Vietnam military history is very different. And I think very, very beneficial for the country. And I'll say
If it's studied by the right people and it's understood what the real lessons are. I mean, in this recent chapter of our history, the last year, 18 months, we've seen a lot of things come out of the woodwork, including this tremendous documentary epic from Ken Burns and Novick, and also a book on way about, this was written by Mark Bowden, these things are these huge epic works, but they're filled with misconceptions and views that probably are real, but they're in a very narrow segment of our society, and they're based largely on what I dub the anti-war crowd, okay? So where this is taking me, I'm very proud that some things that I said that I wrote in a book were read by guys that had to go into harm's way and learn from them and did things the right way instead of the wrong way at that moment in time. It's not, like you said, it's not a perfect science, and there's going to be people that go, oops, you know, I shouldn't have done that. But for the most part, you know, this is an ideal thing, and I for one, and I believe everybody that's done this at all, who has spent an hour with a fire team, and I've done probably now 50 or 60 PMEs over the last 20 years, it makes you feel good. It makes you go, hey, okay, this is why I went through all that shit I went through during that 1 year and all my weird memories ever since then. This is the reason why.
Has led me to this.
Makes me feel real good. Right. Okay. Right. But I also am now, I'm pushing really hard on, you know, I'm going on this trip, right?
Well, I want to stop you for a second, and before we talk about the trip, I got to take a break, and then we'll talk about the trip. What I want to ask you though is, give me your thoughts on the Burns Novick PBS documentary, the Vietnam War. I've had very, very interesting conversations, and have heard the whole spectrum of comments from Vietnam veterans too. I thought it was, for such a topic, for such a broad topic, I thought it was a balanced representation, too. I watched the first episode. I turned that shit off. I won't watch it again. It's an anti-war
everything
piece.
In between.
And everything in between. where do you shake out in that spectrum? We'll continue our interview with Nick War when we come back on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.